Welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast, brought to you by political expert Robert Morris and that man you wish would stop interrupting him, Rory McElhone. Welcome to the More Freedom Foundation with 30% more freedom than other political podcasts.
Indeed, indeed. What we bring is the honesty, I think.
Yes.
So how are you doing this week, Rory?
I'm doing well. Same old, same old. It's just getting darker, so it'll be soon. I'll start work in the dark and come home in the dark.
Yeah, the weather in New York right now has been just insane. It's like really, really pleasant, which is in marked contrast to my attitude towards politics in the United States right now.
Oh, nice segue.
Yeah, right. We've got. I want to talk about the midterm. That's what I want to talk about. But for people who might be...
Well, I've been worried talking about it. It's quite a difficult subject, but I'm glad I'm with an American political expert. With how many years were you living in Washington?
I lived in Washington, D.C. from 2003 to 2011, which were certainly quite tumultuous years. I can remember Barack Obama's election. That was a huge party in Washington, D.C. I can remember his inauguration. That was an insane party in Washington, D.C. I think I remember it was like a dance party and a pizza joint. Buddy of mine wearing wings for some reason, running up and down the top of a bus. It was quite something. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the Bush years and Bush inaugurations didn't lead to quite as many celebrations in Washington.
Well, he's not quite the orator as Obama.
Well, also Washington, D.C. is. This is a cliche that I think is entirely true. It is a very liberal, democratic-focused city. When the Republicans...
Okay, because I wasn't quite sure, because I know quite often, you know, capital cities that are purely the, you know, government, but not really got anything else going can often be a bit drab.
It was drab until Afghanistan, really. We have to be grateful to Afghanistan and Iraq for making the Washington, D.C. food scene very exciting. I got to witness the transformation of Washington, D.C. from exactly the sort of backwater that you describe into a place with just an absolute ton of money. For the 5 years after the financial crisis, the richest jurisdictions in the country were all around Washington, D.C. They weren't in Washington, D.C. proper, but they were in suburban Maryland and Virginia, which are outside of the district, but very much benefiting from the war on terror, this incredible grift that mostly improved Washington, D.C.'s quality of life.
And not Afghanistan.
Of the 2 trillion spent on Afghanistan, I think 1.9 never really made it outside of the Beltway.
Well, doesn't a lot of it get, it's like spent back? Because if you look at the numbers for Ukraine right now, quite often America is paying itself for a lot of like ammunition, for instance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So quite often, say, if they're giving, you know, a couple of billion, it's like most of that billion is like, oh, we're giving them bullets, or we're going to pay ourselves for them. So it's actually not quite as much as it would first appear.
Absolutely. The thing was with the war on terror, as distinguished from Ukraine, is that there wasn't really anybody to fight that was real. And there wasn't really there wasn't anybody to intervene. There was no intervening mouth at the trough. The Ukrainians have a real war that they are fighting with real goals and real things that they need to do.
Cruise missiles and jets.
Yeah. The war on terror was just a nonstop splurge. True smorgasbord. Washington, D.C. Profited and very few else did. But when it comes to domestic politics, I wouldn't call myself that much of an expert. I pay attention. As with a lot of my expertise, there's just something really basic that I feel like I'm noticing that a lot of other people are missing, or rather that the U.S. media in general is missing. And I kind of want to, I think this will hopefully make this a little bit more of evergreen content, not just linked to these elections next Tuesday. Yeah. But I want to talk about media bias in the United States and how it's not exactly what we're told it is. Like, do you have a sense of how media might be biased in the United States, or?
Well, the obvious one, it seems that it's sort of portrayed there is a liberal bias, but quite often when you see the likes of Fox, it does just seem, I can't see them ever saying anything good about the Democrats, for instance. It tends to be a sort of a cavalcade of horror stories that says you have to vote Republican or something horrible will happen.
Yeah, it's funny because people, I think people on a lot of parts across the ideological spectrum will talk about this liberal bias in the media. Oh, the New York Times, it's super liberal. Oh, CNN, liberal bias. And honestly, having lived through the 21st century so far, the bias that just screams out to me as we are coming into an election where the Republicans are largely expected to take back control of the U.S. legislature, the bias that's just screaming at me is a massive, extraordinarily illogical pro-Republican bias. Like it's stunning to me that we don't talk at all about what Republican governance has meant for the past 40 years and specifically for the past 20 years. It's just mind-boggling to me. Like it just
what outlets would you say are the, you know, showing this the most?
Every single one. Every single one. Because
so all the ones that are supposed to be on the Democrat side are quite happy to trumpet Republican sentiments?
Everybody. It's just like, let's look at what's happened this century. Let's look at the insane crises that the United States has gone through, and let's look at who is responsible for them. I mean, 9/11, September 11th, like, that was on a Republican's watch, and what the Republicans in power did after 9/11 was do everything in their power to cover up Saudi Arabia's responsibility for that attack. You have the 2008 financial crisis, which is a direct result of Republican governance. You know, Republicans had been in power for 8 years leading up to 2008. Mm-hmm. And you can argue that there were...
So that's two terms then?
Yeah, yeah. You can argue that there were some Clinton choices, choices of the Clinton administration in the 90s that helped to lead to the 2008 financial crisis. But those were mostly the sorts of choices that the Republican Party had been advocating most heavily since Ronald Reagan in 1980. That was all financial deregulation. Mm-hmm. That was all letting Wall Street off the hook. That was all unchaining the big banks to do great things. So that's the 2008 financial crisis. There is the war in Iraq, which is, you know, killed a million people in the Middle East, created...
Is it still going? What's the situation there?
Well, the situation in Iraq is that we've got... I've got a video coming up fairly shortly talking about U.S. involvement in the Middle East. As far as U.S. troops in the Middle East, we've got, I think, 1,000, maybe 1,500 guys in Iraq. The Obama administration was somewhat transparent about troop levels, though the the presidential administration didn't always have the correct numbers. It comes out that occasionally the Pentagon lies or just misconstrues the numbers. The numbers are also really easy to fudge because you've got some regular troops. Those are the numbers that we actually get. Yeah. And then you've got contractors, and then you've got this, that, and the other thing. But as far as Iraq and Syria, we've got probably the general understanding is, and the Trump administration just stopped giving out any information at all. But the general understanding is that we've got 1,000, 1,500 troops in Iraq and Syria each. And then we've got tens of thousands of troops in the Gulf monarchies. So, yeah, we're not super involved in ongoing...
Keeping the World Cup safe?
Sorry?
Just the World Cup this year is in Qatar, so you're keeping it safe.
Yeah, well, that'll be very interesting, actually. What involvement the United States has in keeping that safe. The main in-theater headquarters of CENTCOM, the big U.S. combatant command, is in Qatar. So that's, I believe, to the somewhere between 9,000 and 12,000 U.S. troops, and then you've got contractors, and then you've got civilians, and then you've got this, that, and the other thing. So that's probably, I mean, the World Cup itself is already a massive security
event.
Having
even when it's in somewhere, you know, more secure, like say Germany or England.
Yeah, you've probably got the population of Qatar a couple times over coming in for these events, and you've also got really sensitive, important U.S. military facilities headquartered in. Geez, I hadn't even really thought about this yet, but you've certainly beginning to convince me that the Qatar World Cup is potentially a pretty grim flashpoint. You got CENTCOM there. You've got all of the dignitaries and celebrities that'll be coming in. You know, gosh, I mean, if there's any worldwide terrorism left that's worth its salt at all, I'd expect Qatar to be rather a big destination.
Thinking for football violence, heat tends to drive people mad.
True, true. So yeah, quite a combustible situation. Though I think making it little bit safer is that. The Qatari royal family has a big history, a big funding relationship with international jihadi terrorism. So, you know, perhaps folks won't be pooping where they eat or what have you. But yeah, I'm not sure there's much more of that to talk about. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about, it's just the, you know, 9/11, 2008, the Iraq War, and then Donald Trump's spectacular mishandling of the COVID crisis. This is actually a really great example of the media bias that absolutely everybody engages in. Because if you talk about Donald Trump and the COVID crisis, living through it, and even I have family members who are very Republican, and I remember living it through it with them. And they, you know, folks who are huge Donald Trump boosters, just watching these press conferences and being like, my God, what have I done? Just who is this absolute clownish baboon? And, you know, I think Donald Trump, for the beginning of his presidency, sort of kind of proved in a way that you didn't really need a U.S. president for things to, you didn't need a competent U.S. president for things to tick over. But occasionally something went wrong and you really needed a U.S. president.
Well, it's a bit like when a country doesn't have a government, it can struggle along for a certain amount, but then certain things need rubber stamped, and you know, over time it will start to like build up.
Exactly, things start to break, and what happened with COVID was something massive broke, and we needed a real executive, and we didn't have
but
one.
But wasn't there another issue? Was it before Trump got in? Didn't they? Was it the House they governed?
Oh, well, so Republicans certainly had control of houses of Congress. I want to say from 2010 on, it's not...
Because I heard with the, you know, when they hit the debt ceiling, they forced the Democrats to come to an agreement to cancel, was it $2
billion? Honestly, that's talking about COVID preparations that they were forced to...
It was obviously at the time it felt like, you know, preparing for an asteroid. It, you know, was one of those things you just hear and assumed would never happen. But then tragically, it did. So because of that, some of the safety net had been removed prior to Trump's arrival.
Oh, there's no question that Donald Trump. Well, interestingly, George W. Bush, a Republican president I have very little sympathy for, was pretty serious about pandemic preparedness and put a lot of resources into it. It was followed up by Obama, who also put a lot of resources into it. And then the Trump administration just sort of dropped the ball completely, had no interest in doing anything related to this. And yeah, I'd have no doubt.
Why
that
do you
certain
think that
elements
was?
Because Donald Trump was just a clown. But what's so extraordinary, and this is the piece, this is one really egregious piece of media bias that absolutely everybody buys into, because this is something that, and it's worked. It's worked incredibly well with a bunch of folks, you know, normies, a bunch of folks are like, you know, to give Trump his due, you know, with Operation Warp Speed, and he really did a great job with those vaccines. And it's just like, exactly. It's laughable, But that's what most people in the United States believe, because that's what most media outlets in the United States say.
But didn't he drag his heels as much as possible?
He absolutely did. See, what Operation Warp Speed was, in May, long after the barn, the horses had run away.
Yeah.
And the barn was open. The United States had become the super spreader of super spreading countries. Mm-hmm. We had just spent 2 months watching Donald Trump's clown show. He was already talking about, we got to open up the economy and blah, blah, blah. He was just this nightmare mm-hmm. person. Somebody, I don't know if it was Kushner, I don't know, talked him into we desperately need an executive to handle this. So yeah. Operation Warp Speed was created, which was what we would have had. I'm no fan of Hillary Clinton, but what mm-hmm. we would have had in January of 2020, if we had yeah. Hillary Clinton, was a competent executive who was taking steps. And Operation Warp Speed, there was some doctor that was put in charge of it. There was definitely money released to Pfizer, to, mm-hmm. to Moderna, to these places. And yes, the vaccines...
Maybe 2 months too late?
It was 2 months later than it could have been.
Yeah.
And the idea that Donald Trump deserves some kind of credit for mRNA vaccines that were actually already formulated in January of 2020 and took, about 8 months to make it through the FDA approval processes and whatnot. The idea that Donald Trump deserves some kind of fucking creds. I keep swearing. I should stop doing that. The idea that Donald Trump deserves some kind of credit mm-hmm. for successfully taking himself far enough out of the equation to allow a few competent executives to get these drugs out by the end mm-hmm. of the year. The idea that Donald Trump is somehow to be applauded for Operation Warp Speed is laughable, but it's what everybody in the United States believe.
Okay, because I haven't been following the media, mostly from, UK sources. I'm getting it, so I'm not getting the both barrels that you'll be getting.
But I think if you ask most Americans, it'll be sort of conventional wisdom. But Trump did a lot of things wrong. But that Operation Warp Speed was pretty great.
Okay,
and it's part of the just bare bones idiocy of the standard American voter that attributes everything that's happening to the U.S. president.
Yeah, well, most of it's just sort of was happening anyway,
especially economic stuff, inflation.
Well, you were explaining, fuel prices are quite often outside of the president's control. There's levers he can pull, but he can't pull them all.
Exactly. And I think Biden has been pulling the levers that he can pull, mm-hmm. which is releasing fuel from the strategic reserve. That's about the limit of what he can do. There's also, this is another thing, is that people just don't challenge basic Republican talking points. They don't mm-hmm. challenge this idea that Biden's been super woke and he's been somehow shutting down the oil and gas industry in the United States. That's mm-hmm. simply not true. We produced dramatically more oil and gas than we produced when Donald Trump left office.
Yeah,
that's just a fact. Now, it is an incredibly complicated industry. There are many different levers. You can construct a case that ESG matters in certain ways, but somewhat sympathetic view that, Biden got in there and he's been just getting in the oil industry's way is frankly nonsense. It's just not something that's actually happening. He's desperate to try to do things to make the oil industry happy. The main reason there's two reasons, I think, that the oil industry is not producing to the extent that it could, mm-hmm. is A, they don't like Joe Biden much, and B, because they went through this period of time coming to a conclusion in 2020, the sort of darkest days of COVID, where they spent a decade just not making much money. Mm-hmm. They just did not, because they produced too much. And what happened in 2020 and the bankruptcies related to not just bankruptcies, but I just read a long article on Exxon, which is sort of the king of the oil companies. It is the largest private, but it is a public company, but it is a private. It is in the private sector. It is not a state.
Yes.
It is not a state. I think it is the largest non-state-owned oil company in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, they went through a horrific time in 2020, had to lay people off, which is something they didn't
well,
do.
Well, yes, the oil price went negative. Isn't that right?
Exactly. The oil price went negative. And finally, after a decade of just developing every resource possible, pumping as much oil as possible, because the people in the industry just sort of believed that they could make money.
Was there
no
a
matter
lot to
what.
Do with fracking? Because they're quite fragmented. You know, like as an example, OPEC basically say we're going to produce X amount and then they all do it. Well, because there was so much competition with fracking, were they not basically just like pump as much as you can so you'll make as much money, which then meant there was a glut of oil?
Well, the United States oil and gas industry, as I understand it, has always been much more fragmented in that way and mm-hmm. much more amenable to, you know, big characters and Texas oil men. And mm-hmm. maybe you saw that film with Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, There Will
Be
Blood.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That obviously that's greatly romanticized, but there is that there are huge nation state sized or at least nation state powered actors in the U.S. oil
yeah.
and gas industry, but there are also many smaller businesses, mm-hmm. you know, entrepreneur maverick types. The oil industry is one of the most important things to understand about the oil industry that I got hanging out with some oil and gas guys in Turkey years ago is it's exciting. It's
yeah.
fun, you know?
Well, it's also dangerous, which adds to the excitement.
Exactly. It is to be out there prospecting. There's just something about that just scratches an itch.
Yeah. But as far as I'm aware, it's one of the few businesses where you could make Silicon Valley money.
You can. And the expectation that was built into people after, mostly because of China, mostly because mm-hmm. of China's magical decades in the late 90s, from the late 90s until 2008, essentially, mm-hmm. had China growing at 8 to 12% a year,
yeah.
and its demand for oil and gas growing even faster than that. So there was this culture that was established in oil and gas, and it's been established in oil and gas at other points mm-hmm. of hypergrowth. But it was really emphasized from the late 90s to the early 2000s, where no matter how much we build, no matter how much we pump out there, we're going to make Silicon Valley style money.
Yeah.
And what had been happening, what certainly happened and brought everybody crashing into this realization in 2020 with that month of negative oil prices, mm-hmm. But it had already actually been happening for about 5 years prior to that as well, was they weren't making Silicon Valley money. They weren't making mm-hmm. any money at all. There's the, in the aggregate, this is again, you know, it's an in the aggregate kind of figure. I mean, who does the math on this? How does that math work? So you're taking something on faith here, but in the aggregate, I believe that between 2010 and 2020 or thereabouts, mm-hmm. the oil industry is reckoned, the U.S. oil and gas industry is reckoned to have destroyed $300 billion worth of shareholder value. So that's just, that's $300
billion.
$300
billion. Wow.
$300 billion of investment that was
is
poured
that
into
than
oil
a quarter
and gas.
Of a trillion?
Wait, 300 billion. Yes, that is more. That is on the way to a third of $1 trillion.
Oh my goodness.
Of investment, I mean, of Wall Street money, essentially,
mm-hmm.
that just disappeared, that just went poof. So what Biden is dealing with is the fact that a lot of the oil and gas industry leans Republican, does not like mm-hmm. him, but also the oil and gas industry is for the first time in a decade is thinking to itself, oh, wow, we actually kind of need to make money now, or we're
they're
not going to have,
black.
Or we're not, they are now, but like, mm-hmm. but they're also exerting some discipline around this because they're so traumatized by those negative oil prices.
Oh, absolutely.
So like, if we're going to continue having a company here, we need to actually make some money. So the
but
idea
the
that.
The way they're doing that is to, instead of meeting demand, is to basically just find where demand is and produce slightly less. So there's always going to be a good price there.
Yes, that's That can be portrayed in a very sinister light, but that can also be portrayed as just good business, which is we really benefited. Everybody benefited. I made a video a couple months back talking about how China really benefited. China's the end of China's growth miracle would have been apparent much sooner if it weren't for the U.S. oil and gas industry subsidizing China.
Because China does produce a lot of oil, but it consumes it all, so then it needs more after that.
Yes, yeah. China definitely has its own oil industry that is completely, completely eaten up. It's what the United States was from the 1970s until 2020, arguably.
We produced a similar amount?
Not similar amounts. Throughout the existence of the petroleum industry, the United States has always been one of the largest producers. But
well, that's something I find fascinating. If you look historically, like America produces more than anyone, like any way more than the likes of Saudi Arabia for a hell of a long time. And is it producing more than anyone else currently?
Yes. Oh, yes. It is the number one producer.
It reclaimed that crown. But it's amazing how sort of, I don't know whether it's because America has such a dynamic economy that it's hard to focus on specifically oil. But you'd almost think they hardly made any the way people go on. It's nearly always just Saudi Arabia, and occasionally Russia.
Yeah, I agree entirely. That's the sense that you would have. And between, to be clear, between the 1970s and the 2015 to 2020 period, it's complex and there's caveats here. But in between, we were by far a net importer. We needed Middle East gas from the 1970s until the 2010s. And interestingly, California, because its system is disconnected from the rest of the country.
Yeah, it's because of the, what's the mountain range?
The Rockies.
The Rockies. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, they're almost like a little country in themselves in that sense.
Yeah, so California still uses a lot of Saudi and Iraqi oil. Okay. The rest of the country has no need for it, which is kind of a fascinating. And the thing to know about oil and gas markets is that everything is more complex than it seems. Because, you know, we have the WTI, U.S. oil price, and we have the Brent sort of more or less world
oil price. Yes, I've been to oilprice.org, and you're like, why is there like 700 different prices for the same thing?
Well, because it oil less so, but gas much more so. These prices are dependent on where you are and what the infrastructure is.
Also, the quality of the oil as well.
Exactly. And the nature of the refineries and what those refineries are used to handling. So it is a lot more complex than that. In the aggregate, the U.S. is more energy secure and more energy productive than it ever has been under Biden.
Has America's energy demands plateaued, essentially?
Well, that's a very complicated question with a very technical answer that I don't have at my fingertips, to be quite honest.
Okay. No, I was reading that quite often it seemed to be around 2005, both like Europe and America, you know, started to become more efficient and aware of limitations and also just weren't growing as much. So their energy demands have actually plateaued, while it tends to be the rest of the world is now sort of catching up, and particularly China.
I know for a fact that U.S. and European emissions have been falling for a decade now. As far as like actual energy demand, I'm not 100% sure on that, because I know that by a lot of measures, going electric with electric vehicles will require much more electric power generation.
But I've heard that it could also help stabilize the grid, because A, you basically have a load of battery power that grids may tap into that, say, give you a discount if they can take some of your electric to help with the grid. But also a lot of electric cars are charged overnight, which is the time the grid would loan people.
I think that's a very
electric.
Strong possibility, but there's also technical.
Well, I've heard the grid saying there's a lot they're looking. Well, they kind of see it as an interesting challenge. You know, it's hard to know. We'll know in 20 years.
Yeah, there's
both are considered plausible.
There are so many things that are plausible, and what's interesting. Yes.
But more trains would probably help.
not really in the United States, I think.
could make a lot of sense. It's just through a lot of willpower to get rid of them. Did you hear that Elon Musk wanted, it was promoting the Hyperloop to kill Californian
I
high-speed
did,
rail?
but I also think that the California high-speed rail pretty efficiently killed itself.
No, it's still going, is it not? On the
I
way?
thought it had been
It's
canceled.
being built. No, it's getting there. It's going to take a long time. Did you not hear the controversy of Real
I
Life
did not see
Lore?
the controversy with real life lore, no.
Oh, he made a video and he was accusing things of, he says, oh, it's going away out into the middle of California to these like posh towns instead of going along the coast. And this obviously a man that knew a lot about what he was talking about was basically like the main enemy of the train is elevation. And it's going that way because it's the flattest. While if you go along the coast, it's quite mountainous, and it's also literally on the coast. It was basically like half an hour, and then Real Life Lore took down that video and then uploaded one basically saying it's actually quite a good idea. So no, it seems like it is very plausible. It's one of these things everyone seems to think, oh, Americans don't need it, but I know that obviously the Chinese high-speed rail is very, very different, but I do believe it could be
Well, I think
possible.
high-speed rail in California, high-speed rail in up and down the East Coast, those are very good ideas that also are probably not going to happen because of the way that US,
Yes, anytime soon, I
because
can
of the way
understand
that
that.
the United States currently handles everything related to construction, permitting, environmental assessments, this, that, and the other thing. So high-speed rail, and this is a real problem actually with Biden's general, I think it's generally lauded accomplishment of the Inflation Reduction Act with a pretty terrible, terrible acronym that's used quite often, I think, from the Irish perspective. I think there's a real problem with that is that it did free up a ton of money for beneficial projects for the environment. The problem is that without permitting reform, that's just one small aspect of things that we need, but constructing things in the United States is extraordinarily, appallingly difficult. And the UK has this to a lesser extent. It's interesting, France famously has some difficulties with construction because of unions. The UK has some difficulties with construction because of lack of powerful eminent domain laws. The United States has all of those problems and about a million other problems besides. It literally takes billions of dollars to build two or three stops of subway in Manhattan. I don't have the exact figures at.
Well, it's very difficult to build subways, and building anything in a city underground is difficult. I think Rome's got one of the most difficult because they keep finding incredible archaeology. So they're like, yeah, we have to stop building this bit of the
Sure,
subway.
but
But I can understand subways are difficult, but yeah, I just think there could be a lot more interconnected railways. You don't even need to have high speed. If you have a lot of railway and a lot of trains, it can build up.
But Rory, I can almost, I won't guarantee that the New York subways are like an order of magnitude more expensive than those incredibly complicated Roman subways, but I would argue that they are at least 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 times more expensive. So I think that it's nice to talk about doing high-speed rail on the East Coast and the West Coast, and it's nice to talk about all these transmission lines that we need to do, but we need to make extraordinary changes to
Reform.
extraordinary reforms that nobody's really talking about.
Do you think a lot of it is what they call nimbyism, just people not wanting things
For
changed?
sure, for sure. But it goes beyond nimbyism to just a simple level of deference to property rights in the United States that I think the United Kingdom has to a degree. We have much more strongly, and really nobody else has. I think this is apocryphal. I could be wrong about this, but I think that the Channel, and this could be incorrect or apocryphal, it's too good to check, but I think it does illustrate the difference in laws. The France leg goes much, much faster than the England leg because the French were like, oh, we need to build this. Here's how we do a straight line. Property owners, I'm sorry, we're taking this, we're doing this. Here is the amount of money we've decided you get. And this is what we're doing. British have is that I believe it is a much shorter chunk of land that is traversed in England before you get to the tunnel. And that in the United States, we've got that times like a million. And you consider the prices of real estate in California, and that's why high-speed rail in California is just such a famously extraordinarily expensive boondoggle that they've been talking about for decades.
Well, I've heard of one argument is some of these things are just expensive, so you should really just say it's going to cost a trillion and that's just the price. But quite often they lowball it to get it through Congress or whatever and then add on the real price later.
Well, if you say it's going to cost a trillion, it'll cost $3 trillion.
No, well, that's what they're saying. They're saying if you say, quite often they'll say, oh, it'll cost X billion, but they know it'll cost a trillion. But if you said it costs a trillion straight up, people would just go, that's too expensive, and it would never happen.
Well,
so there's an argument to if you need infrastructure, you just have to pay.
But the thing is, though, if you put it through Congress and you put it through to the contractors and you put it to the consultants at the price of $1 trillion, it'll end up inflating to $2 trillion anyway. That's just one example of just how broken building things in the United States just happens to be. It's just the infrastructure here is kind of a nightmare. And I think it speaks actually to, like, you just need time to fix things in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the problem, and this strikes me, I feel a little dirty saying this because I'm going to sound like just such a cliched, Democratic partisan, and I'm not. I don't like Democrats. I think Democrats are kind of irritating and snooty.
Such a cliched Democrat partisan.
Yeah, I feel that way, but it's just like what we've had in this country for 40 years now is incredibly irresponsible Republicans who come in, spend all this money, break all these things, cause all these nightmarish problems, and then you have Democrats then come in and clean things up for 4 to 8 years, and then everybody gets sick of them because they're annoying killjoys, and we bring back the fun Republican Party time. Like, Rory, what's extraordinary is people really believe that the Republicans are the party of fiscal responsibility, which is...
Well, I think it seems to overlap with the Conservative Party here, which they seem to just spend money on themselves and their friends.
Well, no, that's the thing. In Britain, the Conservatives actually are heartless, austerity people who do cut services mercilessly. They're terrible. The Republicans don't
also cut police and the military, which is something you'd never hear the Republicans doing.
The Republicans don't cut anything. The Republicans in the United States are the most insanely fiscally irresponsible people ever. Whenever they get into government, you just look at the deficits. Obama, because of the 2008 financial crisis that Bush created, in his first year or two in office, he had these insane deficits because you needed that. Just disaster recovery as you needed in the first year of Biden or what have you, because you need to spend money to get the country out of these holes that Republican presidents tend to drive the country into whenever they're in power. But other than that, the Clinton administration, they balanced the budget for the first time since Eisenhower. Like the incredible fiscal responsibility from the Clinton administration. The Obama administration inherited these insane deficits, these trillion-dollar wars from Bush, reduced the deficit every year he was in power. Trump got into power, and instantly, after long before COVID, instantly jumped up to trillion-dollar deficits. Like
But then they blame the Democrats.
Exactly.
But Obamacare, you have to realize it's all Obamacare's fault.
Yeah, Obamacare,
because it costs money,
which they've stopped talking about. So it's lunacy.
Is Obamacare popular?
Of course it is. It depends.
Because over here, American healthcare is very complicated.
American healthcare is a nightmare, and I think if we'd have to do a dedicated episode on that. I think Obamacare is a series of band-aids that did a number of just essential things. Like, before Obamacare, we have these insurance policies in the United States that you spend too much money on. We still have that. Before Obamacare, you could reach a point where your health insurance ran out. So, like, in the United States, you have to pay, you know, you're paying thousands of dollars a month for this health insurance in case you get hit by a bus. And then you get cancer. And before Obamacare, you could, you've paid for this your whole life.
Insurance.
And then you'd pass $250,000 or you'd pass $500,000. And then the insurance company would come to you and say, yeah, sorry, you're out. You're done. You're done with the money. We're not going to pay for your care anymore.
Yeah, that's horrific.
Yeah, that was something before Obamacare. Before Obamacare, you could be, if you had gotten sick somewhere else, you had something that was called a pre-existing condition, which would mean that you changed a job and you needed to get new health insurance. You couldn't get health insurance because you'd been sick before. That was something that Obamacare fixed. Those were nice. But also Obamacare was this insane handout to insurance companies. It basically was a way to make insurance companies richer while also, as a side effect, you know, mildly expanding health insurance coverage in the United States. But that's a that is a whole nother nightmare problem.
It is.
But at least so Democrats,
it's been a success on the whole, so they don't talk about it.
Yeah, I think they talked about Obamacare a ton until the beginning of the Trump administration when the Republicans had full control of the
United States. They did nothing.
They had both houses of the U.S. Congress. They had the presidency, and they'd been talking for 8 years about how evil and terrible Obamacare was. They had complete control to do something about it. And then they realized, wait a second. This is the Republican Party for you. They had talked about this for 10 years. It was a central plank, was the evils of Obamacare and how
I remember hearing a lot about it.
And how we're going to do better. And like, you know, this is, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they got there and they were like, okay, so what's our better plan? They're like, no, nobody came up with a better plan. Nobody has a better idea. And if we actually repeal this, then we're going to go back to the period of time where, like, if you get cancer, you run out of coverage or you can't get insurance anymore because of pre-existing conditions. And the Republicans were like, wait a second, if we do that, then we're never going to get elected again. So they basically they chickened out and then they just shut up about like one of the main things they've been talking about for 10 years. And this is the kind of like this is the kind of hogwash.
Media bias.
This is the kind of hogwash that is simply never talked about. There's no consistency. Yeah. There is a media bias towards sort of wokeness more generally or whatnot. And another way of saying wokeness is inclusion. Another way of saying inclusion.
Progression.
Or well, no, it's broadening markets is honestly what wokeness is.
Absolutely. And it's like selling cigarettes to women.
It's selling cigarettes to women.
But I remember that phrase used to be, it's the 90s. Do you remember that on TV shows? Whenever the dad character would say something horrendous and the child would go, it's the 90s. But now it's just called wokeness.
Oh no, I don't get that. I don't get that cultural reference.
Uncle Phil, can you take a stroll into the 90s, please?
Ma, it's the 90s. You can call it what it is, our monthly visitor.
Well, I'll see if I can find it, but I just remember it being used a lot. Obviously, then now the 90s is like, oh, don't go there.
Yeah, the 90s is, I mean, the 90s is a medieval, you know, the medieval period at this point.
Pretty much the way woke's sort of used now. But no, I'm just saying things like when people are like, oh, well, it was 2008. And you're like, it wasn't that long ago.
The thing about Donald Trump is he made all of that stuff, put all of that stuff into hyperdrive. Wokeness is about inclusion. It's about broadening markets. That is something that the U.S. media actually is about. And I can see why some conservatives are kind of miffed about that. But that strikes me as being subsidiary and much, much smaller than the concerted campaign of unified lying that every media outlet does about the Republican Party and pretending that these people are anything other than a pack of lying anarchists. They have no idea what they're doing. Whenever they're in power, they do nothing but destroy things. They lie constantly. Yeah. They don't understand anything about the United States or how the United States government works. They are a sad, malicious joke party. But they cut taxes, and the people who own every media source in the United States really love
Didn't
having
Reagan
their taxes
cut taxes so much he had to then put them back up.
He had to do that a little bit. And what's
but I heard it's also a bit of a trap, isn't it? Before you leave, you make the taxes really low, so then the Democrats have to bring them up, and then you go, aha, you've brought the taxes up.
Well, that's the thing, is because because Biden's time in power has been so limited and has been so dependent on, you know, plutocrats like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema.
So is Joe Manchin, he's in their party, but because he just has so much power. Is that the gist?
Well, he has so much power because control of the Senate is so thin. But the problem is...
Yeah, is it basically just down to one?
Yes, it's basically just down to one. But the problem is...
And he's a Democrat, so he can basically say, you know, give me whatever I want or I'm not going to pass this?
Exactly. And one of the things that he and Kristen Sinema say is that you can't raise taxes. So what I've talked about how important it is to have Democrats come and be in power for a little while to clean up the insane messes that Republicans make before the Republicans get back in and start breaking things again. And Biden hasn't been able to do many of those essential things because, Trump, Bush did it, cuts taxes to the bone a number of times. Then Trump came in and cut him to the bone again. Obama was able to raise taxes a little bit. Biden hasn't been able to raise taxes at all. So we're in this place where
likely he'll lose the House.
It's very likely he'll lose the House. I think that's most people think that's almost guaranteed. They'll be incredible.
And then is it just gridlock for 2 years?
It's gridlock for 2 years if he loses the House. If he loses the Senate, he'll probably get impeached.
Oh, what's he getting impeached about?
Who cares?
Oh, just they'll say anything.
Anything doesn't matter.
Laptops in Ukraine.
Doesn't matter. Yeah, exactly. Maybe Romney and like Lisa Murkowski, and so he can't be removed because I think to remove him as president, there'd need to be I think 60 or even 66 senators would have to vote, and I don't think it would even be possible for the Democrats to lose that much. But what they can do is the House will start massive investigations of everything about the Biden family. And the thing is, though, like the Biden family is super corrupt. Like they are
they're
pretty gross. They can definitely find and the Bidens aren't as smart. The Bidens aren't as smart as the Clintons either. So they can.
Well, it's seen that the son that died was, intelligent and hardworking, and the son that lived is not the best.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. But also, Biden's got brothers who've just spent their entire life just being sort of corrupt, bottom feeding hangers on. And the Clinton family had that as well. But like, they were really intelligent attorneys who crossed their T's and dotted their I's. There's no question to me that the Republicans can find something real, and they'll just spend. Definitely, they'll have the House and they'll spend 2 years talking about that forever. And if they have the Senate, then they can shut down really any kind of business by the U.S. government for the next 2 years other than investigating the Biden family. And I think that's the most likely result. And they love that because the Republicans don't actually have any real plans other than cutting Social Security and Medicare.
So what's the main policy?
That they don't have one. They don't have any. They really don't. Oh. They'll probably make it a little easier to pump oil and gas, which won't really matter and won't be that effective because the oil industry will have the same constraints that we talked about earlier. The oil and gas industry isn't going to be interested in pumping so much that they lose their profits anyway. So they're going to probably push some oil and gas stuff through the Congress that Biden won't have much trouble with. They're going to try and cut Social Security and Medicare, but they're not going to actually want to. And they're going to rely on the fact that Biden will veto all of that, because if they actually were to cut Social Security and Medicare, then they would not be
lose a lot of voters.
Yeah, they'd lose a ton of voters. So they're going to rely on Biden's sanity to defend them and say, oh, look at how obstructive Biden is from all these helpful things that we're trying to do, because they know that if Biden were to actually sign that stuff in, no Republican would be ever voted for again. So, it's just going to be a joke. We're not going to have that period of time we needed to recover from Republican governance. And U.S. media is just incredibly biased and negligent to just simply not point these things out. It's a sad thing. I mean, who knows? Like, the election is November 8th. It's possible elections can surprise. The problem is that for the last couple of elections, they have surprised pretty heavily against the Democrats.
Well, usually whoever's in charge or whoever has the presidency, they tend to get off worse during the midterms. Isn't that right?
Exactly. And that more or less did happen in 2018, but in 2016 and 2020, the surprises were massively negative for the Democrats. Biden did win in 2020, but he was expected to have coattails. He was expected.
Oh, yeah, much larger.
Oh, yeah. Everybody was, you look back at the Democratic primaries and it's just like, oh, you sad, sad summer children. The stuff that they were talking about was like, to what degree should we overhaul, the medical establishment? You know, how much should we socialize mm-hmm. medicine? And it's 2 years later, it's like, are we going to be able to hold on to what we established in the 1960s? Is a little more of an open question at this point.
So, Robert, would you like to give any predictions that we will laugh at in a week's time?
Absolutely. I don't know what's going to happen. I think the expectation, I think that we should all be really, really, really excited if this doesn't happen. But I believe the expectation for everybody is that the Republicans are going to win in the House, the lower House of Congress. They're going to win massively. This means that, do you remember the Benghazi thing about Hillary Clinton, those endless, endless hearings? That's what we're going to get on the Biden family for the next 2 years out of the House of Representatives and essentially nothing else. That's what happens if the Republicans win. That's what everybody expects.
And gridlock.
Yeah, they just nothing but Biden family, Hunter Biden laptop, Hunter Biden.
What did he do in China? I've heard this as well. He's up to something in China.
Well, I think this is very standard corruption stuff. Family members of U.S. politicians get sweetheart deals all over the world. The Bush family, you know, the now lionized Bush family, now that Trump is so much worse, everybody loves the Bushes, apparently. They were. I did a video on this years ago. I mean, they were filthy. I think George H.W. Bush had two or three brothers who just spent their entire lives traveling all over the world, enriching the family on the strength of the fact that H.W. Bush and his father were involved in politics. Mm-hmm. And George W. Bush also had a number of brothers, or a brother and a sister, who spent their entire lives just enriching themselves, going around the world because they had father and brother as presidents. That's what Hunter Biden has done.
So the Bidens have followed a proud American tradition?
Of course, yeah, that's what he did in Ukraine, that's what he did in China. Kushner, of course, has taken this to an obscenely higher level, getting literally $1 billion each from Saudi Arabia and
very Dr. Evil.
Just directly $1 billion each from each of those countries.
I always just think what would happen if that happened to a civilian's bank account. It's just one day someone's trying to put $1 billion in there. I'm sure the bank would have a few words with you.
Yeah, that'd be quite something. That'd be quite something. So anyway, what's going to happen is the House of Representatives is going to be Republican, and it's going to just do nothing but talk about Hunter Biden for the next two years.
So he won't get impeached.
Well, that depends. I think the consensus was that the structure of things made it look very likely that the Republicans, you know, the conventional wisdom as of January 2022 was that the Republicans were going to walk away with the whole thing, that they were going to absolutely dominate in the Senate as well. Okay. What has happened in the intervening time is that Donald Trump has helped to choose some of the candidates for these seats that the Republicans are structurally much more likely to win.
Let me guess, is he not good at picking?
You're right the first time, Rory. he's picked a succession of nightmare candidates who are mostly picked because they are either incredibly ideologically extreme or Donald Trump remembers them from the TV. Georgia, we've got Herschel Walker, who is in an extraordinary series of revelations over the course of the past weeks. He's running as a family values Republican. Yeah. He also, I believe, was a very successful college and NFL football player. Mm-hmm. And in recent weeks, we've had a succession of horrific revelations about abuse of children, children he refuses to acknowledge, abortions he has paid for. He's just a nightmare person. He could still win. It is Georgia, after all, but that is one the Democrats will win. It seems possible that that's one that the Democrats will win. In Pennsylvania, which was another likely pickup for the Republicans, they chose Mehmet Oz, who's, Trump more or less helped choose Mehmet Oz, who is like a TV doctor of some sort, I believe, okay. Was made famous on the Oprah Winfrey show. And apparently, this is apparently one of the closing revelations about Dr. Oz is that he used to spend a lot of time slaughtering puppies, running medical trials of some sort. So that's what he's saddled with going in. And there are other candidates that are appalling for a range of reasons. So it does seem possible that against the structure of how things should have gone, it seems possible that the Democrats will hold on to power in the Senate. And that's a very important thing, because if the Democrats do hold power in the Senate, then Joe Biden will be able to continue to operate a government. He will be able to, if somebody needs to be replaced, that needs to be confirmed by the Senate, he'll be able to do that. If a judge needs to be replaced, Donald Trump and his Republican Senate managed to, which I believe Donald Trump had the Republican Senate all 4 years, turned the U.S. judicial system, a very hardcore Republican. A lot of those people are competent attorneys, but a lot of them have no idea what they're doing and are purely partisan actors. The Democrats will largely appoint a higher quality of judge, and also we could use a little bit of Democratic balance. So if the Democrats can hold on to the Senate, those sorts of confirmations can continue.
Okay.
If they do not, and in recent weeks, the polling is beginning to lean towards they will not hold on to the Senate, then Joe Biden can't do anything, really. And the hearings in the House will probably lead to impeachment proceedings. The House goes through some series of processes. You know, he is then officially impeached. That goes to a trial in the Senate that will take place. Because it is incredibly unlikely that the Republicans will be able to put together the 60 or 66 or however many votes that are necessary to remove Biden, we could possibly see multiple impeachment proceedings against Joe Biden over the next 2 years. So we'll spend 2 months, with it bouncing from the House and then up to the Senate, and then we'll do a big trial up in the Senate, and the Republicans will drag that out. And then the impeachment will be voted down, and then the House process will start it all over. And that's entirely possibly what U.S. politics, that's entirely possibly what U.S. politics will be about in the next 2 years.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Maybe we're better off not having a government in Northern Ireland.
It's entirely possible.
That note, we shall see you next time.
Indeed. Get very excited for November 8th. Please, in the United States, go out and vote.
Oh, yeah, vote. Whoever you want to vote for, just vote for them.
Yes, just vote.
And I know someone that has a book about third parties.
I do. I don't talk about that book much anymore. I still sell it, but that is a time before Trump. That is an indication of my time as a sweet summer child. I am no longer a third party supporter. Donald Trump cured me of that.
Well, on that glib note, go out and vote.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better.
Oh, fiddlesticks.